As Roger Tabor pointed out, it's hard to convince a cat to defer to your authority. It's a lot easier to convince a dog that you're a top dog. But if you don't understand dog psychology, you're still likely to run into behavior problems. My guest, Nicholas Dodman, directs the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. He's an expert in animal behavioral research and animal psychology. He's controversial for prescribing antidepressants for some overly aggressive dogs and dogs with compulsive disorders. Dr. Dodman says that feeding time is a good time to persuade your dog that you're the one in charge. I asked him why.
Well, food is a very valuable resource to dogs. It's vital, as a matter of fact. But, you know, if you've ever seen any of these sort of ethology films of, like, wild dogs in Africa, it seems that their whole life is focused around getting up their energy to go and chase their prey, to capture it, to go through their pecking order of ingesting it. Then they lie around and recover, engage in a few other pack activities, and then the next thing is the stomachs are empty and they're off to hunt again. So it's a kind of focal point in a wild dog's life and a focal point in a domestic dog's life. And if you show a dominant dog that you are absolutely in control of its food resource, that you don't have to, you know, be rough with the dog, but you shouldn't be rough with the dog, but if you just make sure the dog knows it has to respond to a command of yours before it's fed, it can make a tremendous amount of difference to the way it respects you.
So in other words, you have to get the dog to submit to your authority before the dog gets the chance to eat.
Well, I like to think you have to command respect in the dog's eyes, which is a little bit different from demanding respect.
Right, right. I put it more like a dictator than...
Right. Yeah, actually, you become a little bit of a hard nose, really, which is very difficult for some people to do.
Well, you know, I know you could feel like a colonizer, you know.
That's right.
You will submit to my authority. You will bow before I give you the food.
That's right.
But that's what you're saying is, you know, get the dog to, like, obey your command and then give the dog the food. Tell the dog to sit or to lie down, and when the dog obeys, then he gets rewarded with the food?
Yes. Actually, there was a very interesting study by a master's degree student here at Tufts working in our Center for Animals, and this, in a very... very clever girl, woman I should say, really, Peggy Schunick. She had engaged a study where she did sort of puppy temperament tests and divided them into various groups. But the group who were potentially dominant, which was the outgoing, sort of forward, sort of in-your-face group of puppies, she split that group into two. And one of the groups, the owners were given no instructions about how to interact with the dog at all. They just said, here's your puppy, have fun. And the other group, they said, we want you to do two things and two things only. One of them is we want you to make that dog sit before it receives its food. And if ever you're going to give it a food treat, make sure it sits before you give it the food treat. And that one maneuver alone in the puppies was enough to engender so much respect that those dogs did not develop dominance, whereas the other group did.
You say that the best way to train a dog is through reward, not through punishment. But what happens, though, when your dog does something really bad, like being on the carpeting or, you know, eating the living room couch? How do you tell the dog that that's bad?
Well, you have to understand what's driving the behavior. And, you know, sort of the old approach to training dogs to behave differently is simply like almost a knee-jerk response. You see a behavior like chewing the couch, and that must be punished. So essentially you're teaching no, you're teaching stop it, you're teaching don't do this, and you really need to provide something constructive, but you have to understand what the nature of the problem is. For example, a dog that's urinating on the carpet when you're out may have separation anxiety, and if you come back and you misinterpret that behavior as being malicious or vindictive and you spank the dog, you're actually adding to the problem and you're not helping that problem at all. If you have a dog that chews the couch because it has an anxious disorder, also that can be a problem. Some dogs have compulsive behaviors that cause them to lick and chew excessively at objects or even themselves. Punishing those dogs is not really dealing with the root cause of the problem.
If you had your choice, would you prefer to have a dog that wasn't a dog that displayed dominant behavior, a dog that didn't want to be top dog?
I guess I would certainly not choose a very dominant dog. But the thing is, if you and your family, I should add, you know, happen to have the sort of personality that you just are sort of matter-of-fact and you sort of exude confidence and you control your dog, you can have a quite a dominant dog who will respond and adore you, and actually they're very intelligent creatures. I mean, the dominant dog is a very smart, fast-learning dog, and they've got, you know, a sort of rock-iron personality. And if your personality is sufficiently elevated, you know, your status is sufficiently high above the dog, you personally will not have any trouble with that dog. And dominant dogs tend not to be very dangerous outside anyway. When they meet strangers, they're usually pleased to see them. I mean, it's almost difficult to annoy a dominant dog. But at home, they can be a pain if you don't make that pack order thing plain to them. If your personality is okay, a dominant dog is okay for you.
It sounds like there's certain types of human personalities that aren't well-suited to certain types of dog personalities.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we've tried to demonstrate that in studies. We did one study that I mentioned in my book that was using a sort of Myers-Briggs, a human personality profile analysis, and had borderline significance indicating that people who own dominant dogs, I mean, it wasn't actually significant, but it was getting that way. I guess it was a trend showing that people might be the kinder, you know, sort of people who had difficulty with dominant dogs, those who are more like Mr. Rogers than Mr. Spock. Spock of the Starship Enterprise would do very well with a dominant dog, and Mr. Rogers probably would have a hard time.
Now, let me ask you, if you're living in a house with other people, say you're married, right? You're living in a house with another person, and you have a dog.
Yeah.
Can the dog think that, you know, that, say, the wife is the dominant personality in the house, and then comes the dog, and then comes the husband?
Oh, yeah. They can get any kind of order.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, men seem to be more immune, partly because they, you know, generally speaking, in a sort of traditional, old-fashioned traditional unit, the man tends to spend more time away. So when he comes in, he's more of a novelty, whereas the woman is there most of the time. And, you know, familiarity can breed contempt. Possibly also because of men's usually larger body stature and forward body motion and perhaps deeper voice, deep tones being sort of telling off tones to a dog. They have a sort of slight physical advantage in terms of that. So often what we find is that the dog is second to the man, but if the woman isn't careful in the family, then the dog can either get close enough to her that some problems, or, you know, may even supersede her, which is what we definitely try and prevent. I had one case
yeah.
where there was a dog. The hierarchy was completely stable with the man was around and the woman was there and the dog was there, and nobody was aggressive to anybody inside that family until one day the man died, at which point the dog immediately assumed the number one position, and presumably it had been number two all along. But when the man disappeared, he then became much more almost sort of abusive and growling towards the woman. And I had the woman work on a dominance control program, commanding respect. And it worked out very well, and that completely disappeared, that aggression.
Is there any way when you first get a dog, when you're choosing a dog, to know whether that dog is a dominant personality?
Yes, I think so. I think that work that I mentioned earlier of the puppy temperament testing, although the general word in the sort of scientific community is it hasn't been proven yet, the fact is I believe it has been proven, it just hasn't been published. I mean, this work that I was referring to. And if you take a puppy who is, you know, in sort of lay language is very, you know, outgoing, sort of in-your-face type dog, puppy, who licks you all over and bounces all over you, as fun as that may be when they're a puppy, those ones seem to be the ones who are more likely to develop into dominant dogs later on. And if you choose a sort of shy and retiring puppy, it seems that those ones are the ones who are more likely to develop the conditions in the anxiety and compulsive behavior spectrum.
My guest is Nicholas Dodman. He directs the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Nicholas Dodman, and his latest book is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. It recently came out in paperback. One of the things you're kind of famous for now is prescribing antidepressants for pets. When would you prescribe Prozac for a dog who was showing dominant behavior?
The answer is really it depends, but it depends on a lot of things. Part of it is the dog, and part of it is the owner, really, in the equation, and sort of their level of desperation. What I would normally do is if a dog came to me that was showing classical dominance, you know, growling over food, resenting a hand over the head, growling and it's disturbed and it's resting and so on, is I would just engage a dominance control program, which is basically termed nothing in life is free, working for a living, some people call it, or no free lunch. And they would work on that for a couple of months. If after 2 months, these people, for reasons perhaps of personality or, you know, just some inability to perfect the program, or just the program wasn't having a good effect on this dog, then I might suggest that we would supplement the program to give them, if you like, a pharmacological leg up in the program. In another instance when I might prescribe it would be if the people who came to see me were in absolute desperation and they absolutely had to see some improvement within 6 weeks, otherwise they'd put the dog down, then I would pull out all stops, and that would include treating with Prozac as well as behavior modification.
Right, that's one of your big concerns, that a lot of cats and dogs are actually put to sleep because of behavior problems.
Yeah, they are. I mean, the figure ranges a bit, depending on, you know, who you read and what year it is, but, you know, minimally, it's sort of in the 4 million, 5 million a year range of animals that are needlessly put to sleep for behavior problems that, you know, a lot of which potentially could be addressed. So, it's the leading unnecessary cause of death in animals. And say, take a condition like aggression, which is one of the behaviors we treat, kills three times as many dogs as cancer.
That's amazing. Do you want to caution our listeners against giving their Prozac pills to their pets?
Yeah, I think it's very important that you don't start giving your own medicine in your medicine cabinet to the dog to see what will happen. It's most important that you do this under the correct professional supervision. There are a lot of sort of potential complications, for example, that some of the antidepressants would be a bad selection in a dog or cat that was potentially prone to seizures. And there are certain medicines that don't mix well that you need to know about combinations. And, of course, most dogs are receiving other medications like, you know, heartworm treatment, and you know, these days some systemic flea treatments are quite popular. And I think it's important to know about actions and interactions, and just to take a pill off the shelf, even though it may be the same pill in terms of actually manufacturing that you would have for a human, and give that one to the dog, you can't really do that without a good knowledge of the medicine and what its effects are and its side effects and interactions.
You know the expression, you can't teach an old dog new tricks?
Mm-hmm.
Is it hard to train a dog later in life when the dog is having behavior problems?
Yes, it absolutely is possible to train a dog later in life. And, you know, we do it every day. But it's also true that younger dogs learn faster. So I think you'd modify the old adage and say you can teach an old dog new tricks, but it just takes longer. There is a certain critical period of a dog's life when it absorbs like a sponge, you know, arguably between sort of 4 and 10 weeks, some people say between 3 and 12 weeks, in the first 2 or 3 months of life, say. And they're absorbing information extremely fast at that time. And they continue to absorb even up until the, fast learning, up until 6 months and sort of puberty. That's, again, still fast, not as fast. And thereafter, it sort of slows down. So after maturity, which for a dog is 2 or 3 years, you're on a sort of fairly level uptake. In fact, in that respect, they're very similar to people. We have the same kind of learning curve. We learn very quickly when we're young. It's very easy to learn a foreign language at a certain time, and very difficult to pick it up when you're sort of 50 or 60.
Dr. Dodman, the cat expert we had on was telling us that he thought that cat behavior problems are on the rise, in part because fewer people are letting their cats out. More people are living in places where they don't feel the cat would be safe to roam around in the streets. And I wonder if you think dog behavior problems are on the rise?
There's certainly more of them being reported, and the most behavior clinics in the schools, veterinary schools, and those practices that specialize in behavior, you know, are certainly having plenty of people come to them, and the numbers do seem to be rising. But it's hard to say whether that means that the number of behavior problems is rising, or whether just people's sort of appreciation of the problems and knowledge now that something can be done, whether that's the reason for the increased number of cases.
Dr. Dodman, do you have pets at home?
At the moment, I have three cats. One very old cat, a geriatric cat who lives upstairs and keeps himself to himself, and a mother-daughter team that spend more time downstairs. I don't have a dog at the moment. My wife had one that died of liver cancer, and at the moment I have to share my neighbor's dog. My neighbor lives out the back and has a nice little border collie cross who practically lives in my garden, and I can go out there and interact with him on a regular basis.
Do you feel that you take on a different personality whether you're with a cat or a dog?
I think probably that's true, yes. I've never thought about that before, but I'm just thinking of me sitting in the consulting room or interacting with my cats at home versus interacting with a dog, and perhaps I do become, you know, a little bit more sort of perfunctory and matter-of-factish with a dog and sort of act as I might do with a you know, I know we shouldn't do this, but I mean, the differential is even acting with my son, I behave a little bit more differently than with my daughter. I don't know why that is. But I seem to be always encouraging him to play rough games, and with my daughter, I'm the other way. So there is this differential, right or wrong, and I think maybe I am a little bit more sort of boisterous with dogs, a little bit sort of more retiring with cats.
Are you more authoritative with dogs than with cats?
I think that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
All right. Well, Dr. Dodman, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Dodman directs the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. His book, The Dog Who Loved Too Much, is now out in paperback. His new book about cat behavior will be published next month.